Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hi everybody, Nate Langson here. Sorry we didn't have a regular show for you last weekend, but one of the things that got in the way of actually making that happen was a festival that I was at called the EdTech Podcast Festival, which was happening here in London. And I was on a panel with three very interesting individuals talking about how AI and education are coming closer together and what can AI do to help education. And so I thought, rather than have absolutely no episode between the last one and the next one, which will be coming up this weekend, why not publish the entire conversation that I had on stage with these eminent guests and give that to you in the week? So that's what's coming up now. So this was recorded at the EdTech Podcast Festival this last weekend. Hope you enjoy it, and we'll be back in a few days with our regular scheduled programming with Ian Morris.
Hello, good afternoon. It is the afternoon. Yes, it is the afternoon. So my name is Nate Langson. In the day, I am a technology editor and journalist at Bloomberg News. And then by night and mostly evenings, I'm also a podcaster and I host a show I created called Text Message, which for the first time ever is projected in large letters above me, which is quite exciting. We're going to spend quite a lot of time today talking about how automation, and specifically artificial intelligence, is creeping more and more into classrooms and study halls. But what's on the horizon and how do we make sure it's effective and not something we maybe look back on and see ourselves using learners as guinea pigs in an experiment that we maybe wish we hadn't done. So to have an interesting conversation, we need some interesting guests, and I'm lucky to have three of them here. I'm going to let them introduce themselves. We'll start to my right.
Okay, hi. I'm Cheska Uy, and I work for a company called Century Tech. Century Tech already produces a platform that has AI in it to personalize learning for students, and it gives the data insights back to teachers. I'm a former science teacher, but now I work in technology to sort of get it out there into schools and make sure it's being used effectively.
Thanks, Jessica. Christina.
Oh, hi, everyone. My name is Christina. I've been living in Australia for the past 10 years, and I've only just been moved back in UK in the last 3 weeks, so very excited to be here. So I work in a company called Navitas. It is a global education company, and we also just recently start our corporate venture called Navitas Ventures, so that is to partner and also invest in those interesting high-potential ed-tech startups and business.
Last but not least, Ben.
I'm Ben Deboule. I was a school teacher, but I escaped and went back to university to do a PhD at the University of Edinburgh in the very, very early days of AI, and started off in AI education back in the 1970s, doing stuff with Logo and primary school teachers. So I've kind of been both a teacher trainer and also a real teacher. And I've been really interested in issues around how we can get intelligent tutoring systems to act like humans as far as they possibly can.
Cheska, let's start at the deep end. You've got a system that blends AI with classrooms. How does that work?
That's a big question, but well, essentially from a teacher's perspective, as that's what I was, and I was teaching science, so I had 9 classes. Each class had around 25 kids or maybe more.
What age group was this, sorry?
I was in secondary, so year 7 up to year 13. And I had to know for each student what they liked, what they disliked, how well they knew different aspects of the curriculum, how well they performed in different skills. And I had to then tailor my lessons for that. So that's before I had to then make sure that they were happy and everything like that. So what our system essentially does is provide the students with a supported way in which to learn parts of their different curriculum that they're exposed to, and be supported in terms of the AI can work out what they should be doing next, whether it's to stretch them, whether it's to support them and go back and do a cross-curricular link. And as a teacher, I know exactly what they've been doing. So then I know how well they've been performing in different areas and actually where then I now need to intervene. So I definitely see our platform, although yes, it's using technology and that's sometimes quite big and scary, actually all it's doing is making me better informed so I can do my job a bit better. And it's taking away some of that stuff that I really didn't want to do, which was give them a test, then mark it, then input the data, then see where the gaps are. Even then, I don't know particularly within a big topic where the gap was.
And what's the interface for this? I mean, we talk about, you know, the interactivity between teachers and students, but is this like a web interface? Is it some kind of device? Like, what is it?
So it's an online platform. So essentially, if you've got a web-enabled device, you'll be able to log in as a student or a teacher, and then you can see your data or your whatever you're supposed to be learning. So you can use it in the classroom if they have devices, or it can be a home learning tool. And then as long as you can get onto the internet, you can access it. So we've got even people out in Dubai, and we're looking at going into the Lebanon to support schools who essentially have the internet so they can use us.
Now, you were a science teacher. And a lot of the conversation around AI and automation sometimes focuses on the fact that it will potentially destroy jobs. Some studies say it will create more jobs than it destroys. But either way, some jobs will go away. So did you sort of duck out of teaching at the right point just before machines take over? Or do you actually see what you're doing as purely complementary and not replacing the fleshier educators of the world?
Yeah, I think... I don't think I ducked out because I thought something was going to take my job. But it's definitely a thought that's out there that, oh, could we just teach just using online platforms? But actually, we know that teachers' jobs are huge and that they don't just span the knowledge acquisition or just getting them to know this one thing. It's so much more than that. It's the communication, all the different people you meet in school, even if it's just your peers. But that quality of interaction, the social and emotional development, probably can't be replaced anytime soon by automation. And that's where we really see, our tool as an assistant to empower those conversations and empower teachers and students to know more about each other and facilitate those conversations.
Well, we're going to come shortly to talking about who's asking for this, who's investing in this in just a moment. But just before we do, Ben, how can we be sure that systems like what Cheska's talked about and what exists in the market as well is able to adapt to individual learners as well as groups? What do we have to look out for there?
Well, there have been quite a lot of studies of individual systems, and we've had enough studies of individual systems that people have written analyses of many studies. And tried to see what the overall picture is.
Like a meta-review sort of
thing. Meta-reviews, yes. Yeah. So, and I've written a meta-review in the sense that I looked at the meta-reviews and tried to see the picture from the individual meta-reviews. And the picture is quite positive. If you compare these systems with what we might call ordinary classroom teaching, they, at least on learning outcomes, maybe not on the social and emotional side, but at least on learning outcomes, they do better, okay? And they do better by about half a standard deviation or an effect size of 0.5, which translates into about 10 to 12% better on average for the kids in that class with a system compared with a classroom. But when you compare these systems with one-to-one human tutoring, they do worse. The skilled individual teacher with one child or with one pupil does better than an AI and an ed system, and that's now averaged over, I think, something like 180 individual studies of systems. So we've got some reasonable grounds for optimism that they do okay, but the criteria that were used were essentially learning gains and not the other more intangible issues around that education also deals with.
Yeah, and you touch on an interesting point there that I'm going to come to you later, but I'm going to do it now because we basically just mentioned it, which is the fact that we do need to maintain a large element of human interaction, not just with children, but with older learners as well. Do you see it being a problematic that essentially we're saying that AI can be better than humans in a class environment?
Yes, I can see it being problematic. It's problematic for a number of reasons. One is because it kind of implies that it's better than teachers in some general sense, as opposed to saying, well, actually, if we think of a teacher with 30 or more kids managing those, that the system, which is essentially one system per child, is doing better. That's not such a big deal. There's a worry that politicians will say, oh well, in which case we don't need to pay teacher salaries, so we can just buy 30 of these boxes and that'll be fine. And that's just ludicrous, of course.
So it's like self-service checkout, but for self-service education.
But who wants, you know? I always go to the checkout person because I actually like the interaction. I think that the vision of schools, maybe not even schools, some centre, a warehouse where kids are bused to and they just sit at a screen all day for the, you know, every day, is ludicrous. It's, you know, we have to put kids somewhere. We have schools for other reasons other than education, because their parents need to work. But the notion somehow that they can just be sitting at screens all day is just silly. And even at the present time, with lovely systems like Century, somebody has to manage the kids' interactions with Century, to introduce it, to make sure that they use it productively, to make sure they know how to reflect on what their experience was. So teachers have got a really crucial role. So I don't see this as AI and Ed versus teachers. I see this as AI and Ed plus teachers. It's an effective classroom assistant, in my view, where teachers can offload some work onto the system, not all of their work, but some work, while they get on with something else. And the something else that they get on with is crucial.
Well, we'll come back to that point in just a moment, Jessica, because I just want to touch on the point that essentially what we don't want then are technologies that are, for want of a better expression, asking kids to put their study books in the bagging area and getting frustrated because that's incredibly annoying in shops, let alone in schools. Christina, when you're, as an investor, when you're looking at the market and the demand and the trends around all of these technologies, where are you seeing that demand coming from? And what are people actually seeing as being the next innovation that's going to help with all this?
So basically, just like probably a year ago, so we did a study around the global ed tech sector, because we're trying to really understand what's happening in that sector. So we had, we actually identify probably there are around like $6 billion USD investment that goes into those post study area, which is like, you know, career planning and also internships. All right, because from an educator perspective, because we also, you know, educate our university students, because we have clearly seen, you know, there's a huge gap, you know, between what they've learned at university versus what they're going to do in their job. And also we see there's a big gap, you know, between the support that students require to be successful and land a good job and post their graduation. So we're seeing a lot of like good technology and solutions just around the career planning stage. So I guess this has typically moved, you know, from, you know, when I was a student, I have to rely quite heavily on those like website-based solution, you know, to get my career guidebook, but now into more those like one-to-one facilitation, you know. So like for example of Navitas, that we have invested quite heavily in those career planning on stage. So that one company that we invest in, they're actually they're building a platform that university they can, you know, plug into their career services. So basically they provide loads of contents, you know, for students to navigate through, you know, how they, you know, should discover their career based on what they've learned, and also, you know, based on, you know, and their CV letters, that how they should, you know, draft those, and then until they can also, you know, based on their student, their experience and what they're interested in, to help them to match with those industry expert network.
This reminds me a little bit, sorry to interrupt, but it reminds me a little bit of when I was at sort of secondary school in the sort of mid-late 90s, that you sort of put in your interests and it would say, oh, you should go and be a policeman, or you should go and work in the army, or you should, and I'm not kidding, once a career advisor told me I should consider being a career advisor because I didn't fit the pigeonholes.
They said that to me too.
Did they really?
I inputted music and psychology and got music psychologist.
That's amazing. That was I'm interested in veterinary care and nursing. Be a vet nurse, which is what my wife is, in fact. So I assume that isn't what we're talking about here. It's a much more advanced, data-driven, informed service that isn't going to tell someone interested in music and psychology that they should be a music psychologist.
So I think that would be two components play into it. So one is really based on the data-driven. You know, so you basically have to answer lots of questions, you know, based on this like huge database and trying to, you know, figure out what you are good and what you are not so good at. And then the other thing is, as we just touched before, that we have to bring those human components into it. So because, you know, by leveraging, you know, those industry experts, so basically students, that they can actually have those very interactive sessions with those people who are actually working in their field. So by talking to them, they can actually really understand, you know, what they are searching for. So I guess like for those technology, they can actually really bring, you know, those experts and alumni and also the students, they all together. So like previously, you know, they probably have to, you know, try very hard to connect each other. But now, because you have this like huge database and have this like huge network, it just become much easier to communicate.
So yeah. we've got these technologies. We have to get people to want to use them, Jessica. People have to want to use these technologies. You create one of them. So if you were going to university, for example, let's say Ben was in charge of deploying technologies, how do you convince Ben that what you've created is A, good for students, and B, not going to steal his job?
Good question. So I think that one of the big things we come across in schools is that the technology that they might use may be great and maybe have so much research behind it and somebody's really thought about it to develop in a great way, but it's given to them, they're given a login, and great, off you go. And that's where the issue lies. There's no one there to sort of say, oh, but why are we using this? How should we be using this? And we know that teaching an individual or teaching a class looks very different if I've got my top set year eight and my middle set year eight. Like, my lessons look very different. So why would I not use this technology slightly differently, and why would I not tailor it in how I use it? So what we do is go to schools and understand them and understand their situation, their students, their devices they have, and then work with them and say, like, so what? How do you want to use this technology? How could it help you? And what solutions could we actually bring? And then we'll work on a consistent way of using this, because obviously if you try and implement anything across a secondary school that's inconsistent, all the kids know how to sort of work out a way around it.
Yeah, I remember doing that.
So exactly. So if you have a consistent way of doing it, actually they see the benefit of it as well, and they understand why they're doing it. And I think that's a big thing, why you're doing it at the outset. Same as we kind of try and promote, why do you even need to bother learning on the platform, is the massive step you need to take before you will then use it and do anything about it. Because you care. Because the teachers, they care, but they only care about using something as a tool if they invest in it.
So, Ben, I read a paper that you authored relatively recently, and you talked quite interestingly about how, in a way, these conversations aren't new. They've been going on for quite some time. I wonder if you could expand a little bit on how this conversation has developed over the last many years.
Well, these sorts of systems, like Century, were starting to be built in the very end of the 1970s. This is kind of like pre-internet, pre-personal computers. And they were massive enterprises of programming by virtuoso individual programmers, which would work in one particular location, and once that person moved on, the system would just die the natural death of any large software system which isn't maintained. So they kind of were built, they were tried out on a few kids, and then they died. What we have now is the fact that we have the internet, we have many tools to help build these systems, and although they're still virtuoso pieces of design work, we've got ways of doing that now that we didn't have in the very early days. In the early days, you would recognize to some extent that what the systems were like. They individualized their interactions with the pupil. They tried to help where they could. They often would allow the person to type in English or whatever language it was, a query or whatever. They would ask in English. But the other parts of the interface, the screens, you know, we didn't have the whizzy screens that we have now, because that's all developed over the last 20 or 30 years. So in the very early days, the guts of the systems were actually rather similar, but the outsides of the systems were completely different.
It's interesting you mentioned language actually there, because one of the points I was going to ask the whole panel is that often when we talk about AI, we talk about it in the context of STEM subjects, and in particular technology, and I think in particular mathematics. That's not always the case, I believe, and language, I think, is one area where AI is proving to be very effective, or is showing signs of being. That's for all of you to comment on. It's less a question, more a statement.
we have Key Stage 2 learners, so in primary school, using our platform to learn about SPAG, so all your spelling, punctuation, and grammar skills, as well as reading skills, because actually without the skills, it is quite hard to access sort of higher level texts and things. And even the secondary school students actually use some of our Key Stage 2 content on the platform, because we realise actually they need to go back and review those skills. And then fast forward to GCSE, we have English literature, English language, because there are elements that you can learn independently, and that's essentially what you do on our system, and then it shows you where else to go. So it is definitely not just a maths and science thing, even though, yes, we're championing technology, it is used everywhere. We use technology in sort of every aspect of our lives now.
Ben, yeah, sure.
We've still got a long way to go with AI in building systems that can actually have a conversation like this. I mean, there are systems that can do reasonably well on fixed topics over short durations and can kind of fool you that they're intelligent over that kind of time scale. But to actually, you know, meet a stranger, go through the rituals of, as it were, how are you, this is who I am, who are you, actually have the kind of conversation that even three-year-olds can manage is actually beyond the state of the art at the moment. So if you think about the way that language is applied in schools, kids trying to explain something that they only half understand themselves, so their language is, you know, that they use the wrong words, their sentences aren't proper sentences, or none of us speak in proper sentences. We might write in them, but we don't speak in them. That's very difficult for a system to actually understand. And likewise, although a system can generate language very well, and even we don't all have to sound like Daleks now with computer-based systems, for the system to understand what the student is saying or what the student's explanation is actually, they can do it up to a point, but it's still fragile. So we shouldn't, in terms of actually, if we wanted to learn French in a conversational way, that's going to be quite difficult. We can learn French with Duolingo, but what that's doing is it's teaching you how to say particular words or very short phrases. It's not actually teaching you to have a conversation in French. Okay, and that's somewhere yet to go.
And do you see demand, Christina, for these kind of systems, language based solution? I hate using the word solutions. I sound like a salesperson. But do you see a demand for that kind of thing?
Yeah. So we quite often that we came across those language learning application, especially for those they are built in those application to teach those non English speaking people, right? And then some of them they do use AI in their technology. I think that's probably more in the way that to correct those students that their pronunciation and probably identify there's a particular deficiency in their grammar. But I completely agree on Ben's point, because so far we haven't really seen much technology that will be really generate a very meaningful conversational thing. I think that more just in terms of this like short phrases and really help you to correct your pronunciation. Yeah, so I think in that space still have a way to go. And also, you know, for them to really to bring this one into the market, so they do have to, you know, collect like loads of lots of data and also probably record like many of those like native English speaking people, how they pronounce it, and can really train the machine to do it. Yeah. So it's a hard work.
Ben, no. I'd just like to come back on this issue about why AI and education systems have tended to work in STEM subjects and not really branch out into art subjects, essentially. It's because they're designed to try to have a really detailed overview of what the student is doing and to help them with their problem solving at a very fine-grained level. Not just, is your answer right or wrong, but is this step a good step to take towards that answer? And in order to do that, they have to have a theory of how that particular domain hangs together. They have to understand physics, or they have to understand the maths, or they have to understand the mechanics. For philosophy or for English literature, we don't operate it. There isn't a model of English literature that you can build into a computer such that you do problem solving in literature. So that's why they've tended to operate in a particular sets of subjects, because actually those subjects allow you to build a model of the subject and also to build a model of the student's acquisition of the knowledge and skills in that subject, which is much harder in social sciences and arts and humanities.
It's interesting because I studied philosophy at A-level, and we go through what is a fairly traditional class of sort of course of moral dilemmas. You know, a train's going down a track, it can go two ways. On one track is an infant, and on the other track is someone who's homeless. Argue which way you should intervene to send the track to. And a computer, I mean, it might be quite terrifying that a computer would make that decision based on what? On the baby's potential value to society, the homeless person's value is, I don't even know, I don't want to be offensive, but, you know, like, it's quite terrifying in a way. I guess why it sticks to maths all of the time.
Well, I think in general, you know, with all of the other areas of AI outside education, it is terrifying where people defer to the system. Rather than saying, the system is going to give you some advice, you know, the system says, based on my analysis of trillions of bytes of data, I believe you should do this. Not that it's going to do it. It says, look, that's my view. You're the human. You take the decision. I'm only giving advice. And the trouble is that people defer to computers these days. You know, that you know, your mortgage is as likely to have been decided by a computer, whereas actually it should be decided by the bank manager. You know, he can use or she can use the computer to help. Shouldn't be the computer deciding. And we've kind of lost track of what agency as humans we have in society, and have allowed systems to overstep themselves. It's great in medicine, for example. It's great that computers can do sometimes better diagnosis than doctors, but nobody is suggesting that it should be the computer that makes the final decision about whether to operate or not. So the doctor has to do that, and we need to make that, keep that balance in mind. I'm really worried about the way that AI is treated like a kind of all-seeing God that we should just sort of bow down before, even though I've worked in AI because I've worked in AI for 40 years, it shouldn't be like that.
Well, we've got time just for one last topic before we get dragged off stage by the metaphorical walking stick from this chap sitting here. So we talk about technology, we talk about the classroom. There's a debate going on as to whether kids, particularly children, have too much technology, whether classrooms have too much reliance on tech, and if that is true, that it reduces their ability to have natural human interactions that help them with social skills, with just how to simply talk to one another. So I want to just close on that point with a point perhaps from each of you as to how you think we maintain that balance between a reliance on computers but a fundamental desire to still talk to our fleshy cousins.
Yeah, I think in schools it's really hard because kids are really engaged with their phones, sometimes more than they want to be engaged in your lesson. So actually, what I've seen in schools anyway, and going around to lots of them, is actually having a real attitude towards using technology in the school that's part of your policy. So actually one school had we use our phones for learning. So they said, so they're basically building those digital skills in their students of how to use your phone, probably as a business person as well. So you can schedule when your homework's due, you can take notes at sort of allowed times and things like that. So actually building those digital skills for students to understand why you might use this technology to help you and when it's less appropriate to use is actually building that ethos in them to go into whichever career they go into, because that is actually something that will a real skill that they're going to need.
It's a good segue for Christina, I think.
Yeah, so I would always think that technology should always be used as a just as an enabler to, you know, to improve the classroom and also to improve the student learning outcome. So I think probably a good way to do it, you know, to balance this human contact and also technology, because I think, you know, when the student they're trying to learn the technology, it will be always, you know, better to put them in a group so they can always, you know, try to learn from each other and try to collaborate and to solve something altogether, you know, through technology. So I think, you know, that's the way, so they can be both digitally savvy and also know how to work with each other.
Ben, you get the final word.
I think in the UK, schools aren't really very relaxed institutions at all. We've managed to get ourselves into a situation where teachers and head teachers are driven by government edict to behave in particular kinds of ways. They're testing the kids the whole time. There are league tables. They aren't really places for relaxed education, as I see it. And I really fear that adding more technology in, there won't be the time for the fleshy interactions that you like. I'm always amazed when my colleagues who are interested in using computers for collaborative work say, but we can get kids in Shoreditch to work with kids in Finland, but why don't they just work with the kid in the next door desk? That would be really good. Okay, so.
What a soundbite to end on, ladies and gentlemen. Ben, Christina, Cheska, thank you so much for being here. And thank you all for listening intently. Please give these guys a round of applause. Thank you.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.